Talk about the Oscars?
Yeah, a little bit. The thing I have about it is that when I was growing up and I would watch the Oscars, I assumed that it was, and I think at one point it was, a good benchmark of what was good. And the thing is, in most years, something that gets Best Picture is something that's like, you know, maybe like a period drama
it's
or something
a standalone
where characters
thing,
are.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You know, the thing about that is that they did a little skit about it during the Oscars, which was Jack Black and Will Ferrell. Did you see a little dance music number they did? John C. Reilly came up and did it. It was about how unfair it was that comedic actors don't get Oscars.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think it's an interesting point because...
Comedies and science fiction
in
2001,
yeah,
I think, maybe got nominated, but I don't think there's been anything that was in 68.
I mean, Little Miss Sunshine was nominated. And before I watched that last week, yeah. I assumed it was... knee-slapping comedy. But it really wasn't. It was one of those indie, feel-depressed-about-everything
sort of,
movies.
Sort of seemed like it might be, yeah.
And the idea is that, like, I think that in the long term, say, 50 years from now, people are going to look back on movies that were made in this last decade, and they're not going to remember something like As Good As It Gets, and they're going to remember something dumb like Dumb and Dumber. They're going to remember that because that's the one that's...
But is that a better movie? In terms of what's up to an Oscar, or... I mean, well,
here's the thing: if they're not going to ever recognize good comedies, there needs to be a best comedy.
The Oscars need
to do it because once in in 20 years is not good enough to recognize that there are decent comedies.
And it shouldn't have to be filled with so much extra drama and subplots about sexuality or whatever the
Absolutely.
Hell is going on.
Absolutely.
It should just be okay for someone to just do a movie that's funny.
Yeah. And did you see any of the Oscar movies this year?
They just look like stuff I was not interested in. And I've gotten to the point where if I want to say that I'm a film student and so I should be a film scholar, I do my best to force myself to see stuff that I know I probably won't get a kick out of. But sometimes I'm surprised by or sometimes I can look at for, the pedagogical value it might have.
One thing I found that I wouldn't want for myself, but it happened anyway, is that if I end up watching any movie that's considered to be good critically or something like that, I will end up liking it. If I watch some garbage about some person who had a dumpster abortion and slit both her wrists, but it didn't quite work out, and then she ended up being an airline pilot, and that was the whole plot of the movie, but it won like best picture, and I ended up watching it, I would be like, that's not bad. I never wanted to see Brokeback Mountain. I never had any desire to do it. And I ended up, it was on Showtime or something one night, so I was like, oh, okay, I'll just watch it. And it was very well-made movie. I didn't enjoy the movie, but I can see why it got the accolades it did. The thing is, though, I can watch, I'll go back and watch just any drama. I'll go back and rent dramas at the local video store that I'd never had any desire to see, but I think, I should watch this.
And because you know enough about structure and stuff, you can see how those pieces are working.
For instance, I love film noir, and I went through a film noir phase.
That's great stuff.
And the only one of those that I didn't want to see was Sunset Boulevard, because it was about a relationship between a guy and a lady, and I had no interest in that. What I wanted to see was the dark crime stuff.
Yeah.
And I ended up watching it, and it is fantastic. I don't know if you have not seen this film. Sunset Boulevard is a fantastic film.
That's funny because my mom's like a real dyed, like heavy-handed, like film noir person. And I got Sunset Boulevard from like a pseudo-estranged cousin over the Christmas. And I said, look, I haven't seen this. This might be an interesting noir. And I asked her if she wanted to watch it with me. And she's like, it's not a noir. It's not very good. So my mom doesn't like it.
Really?
Doesn't
really
consider it a noir. But the definition of noir is a really tough one. It's more of a collection of styles and not so much a genre.
It definitely follows the styles.
I'm sure it follows the styles. I would say that, I know better than her. And it's a noir.
The Third Man.
The Third Man is my favorite noir.
Great. I absolutely love
it. I've always wanted to do a version of that because this is another thing about me growing up in the 80s and watching too many sword and sorcerer and science fiction movies. I always wanted to do a Third Man in space. Not just in space like they've got spacesuits on, but like take the political issues that are going on there.
Right.
Because part of what made the Third Man so great was the city of Vienna, yeah, right. Post-war, in actuality. Like, if you've ever seen the Kurosawa movie, Stray Dog,
yes, yeah,
where he
yeah.
actually shot in, like, post-war Japan, because right. it was made in, like, the late 40s or something like yeah. that. And so there's an authenticity to that that you really couldn't effectively replicate now, but if you put it in this larger scope, then you could have like the cool spectacle of science fiction, but still have the awesome storyline and subterranean chase scene at the end, which just yeah. is fantastic.
And if you put it on the moon, it could equal post-war Japan in terms of
yeah, it could, or just in some larger sense of space. But yeah, so. Noir is a difficult one to ground yourself in, but you're saying essentially that you find you kind of feel guilty that when you do ultimately look at a lot of these movies that are considered critically acclaimed,
yeah,
that you have to just you have to go uncle and say yeah they're good movies.
Well, no, it's not that. It's that I have to say uncle to watch it. It's yeah. that it's that I have to force myself to watch these things because I have no desire whatsoever to see a movie like Hotel Rwanda.
Yeah,
and I watched it and it was good.
Yeah, that's good. You've at least got that. I'm really bad about that. Like. Even in things that I like, mm-hmm. if I hear stuff that's critically acclaimed, and I kind of think that I'm really, really judgmental about stuff nowadays because I just don't feel like I want to waste my time with stuff. Like, it's all about, for me, it's all about, like, do I get the joke already?
Yeah.
And if I feel like, yeah, I get the joke, but the joke's a really good joke, then I'll watch it.
If you like a theme, though, then it's worth it to see everything.
Oh, yeah, that's like, if that joke is the joke you think is funny every time,
then
definitely. It's
worth seeing
all this, like, film noir or... You know, a classic gangster picture. Then, and that's where I kind of falls. It's like, okay, so something like 300 that looks like an action movie, which is more my style. That's you know got some yelling and screaming and cool visual effects. I'm inclined to think that could be cool. But I mean, I'm still looking for something. I'm always ultimately looking for that combination therein, where you get the effective like structure of a good drama, but you still get you know the necessary you know gunfight and
right.
and explosions and stuff that don't seem gratuitous because they are motivated by the story, and that to me is like the epitome of when something is actually good versus ironically good or versus right. just boring and kind of bland.
You know, and it's interesting that there's going back to the Oscars, there's certain types of movies that are completely 100% overlooked in all instances. The only time I can think of anything otherwise, and I know I'm wrong about this, but I used to think for sure that I remembered that Terminator 2 had been nominated for Best Picture the year it came out, which
that
it wasn't.
Is bizarre, though.
It was nominated for a bunch of other things, and I was watching
the visual effects were
telecast. I was watching the telecast, and I thought, for some reason, I convinced myself that it had been nominated for Best Picture, which it hadn't.
Yeah.
But I told myself that for years, that was a great shining example of sci-fi or action, either genre you want to put it in, making it to the big time in the Oscars. And it doesn't happen. One of my favorite writers of any movies is Shane Black, who's the
he did
action.
The Lethal Weapon movies.
Exactly.
And he did,
Lethal
just
Weapon.
Recently did Kiss Kiss Bang
exactly.
Bang.
Okay.
He wrote and directed that.
So
right?
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is... completely different. You can actually find it in the action section if you go on like Netflix or stuff like that.
Yeah,
it's really a parody of film noir basically.
Yeah,
and
it has that aspect
and it's
to it.
Brilliantly written. There's not that much actual action in it. Brilliantly written, and something like that is always going to be overlooked. It's really not the sort of subject matter that Academy voters will like. It's got a lot of jokes about dead people's genitalia and so and, you know things like that. That really doesn't come across as very something you want to be pushing to the masses.
Like highbrow, or you know
exactly. But it really is extremely intelligent, very witty.
Oh yeah, well it's got that parody element, which
yeah.
I think they kind of want to stay with a little. I mean, I don't remember how Adaptation was received critically. If people
it
thought
was
it was
nominated
good,
for
or if it even got
best adapted screenplay,
best adapted
actually.
Screenplay.
Yeah, I think it won.
And that's some
I
humor.
I
don't did it.
I could have sworn that he won it. I think that Charlie Kaufman is an Academy Award winner. I could be wrong. Maybe it's my Terminator 2 thing.
Well, that's
back.
Pretty cool. I mean, maybe I thought that might have been for Eternal Sunshine or something, but. I mean, because it's like at a certain point that is kind of a writer cop out when you just sort of put yourself into the story and then just start doing a parody of a story that ends up being that's the story. You're
Adaptation
telling.
is really very brilliant. I think that
Charlie
Kaufman's other
movie.
Stuff. I really like Being John Malkovich. The other stuff Charlie Kaufman has written has struck me as really self-indulgent. I liked Eternal Sunshine as a movie.
Yeah.
And after watching it, I felt dirty because I felt like I just bathed in hipster.
There was an aspect of that, but I don't know. I enjoyed it as a movie because I felt like it was a decent enough story to facilitate Michel Gondry doing the kinds of like on set special effect, really, like, how do you figure this stuff out? Sort of genius stuff that he does as had done in his music videos, as opposed to something like Science Asleep, which was
I didn't see. I had no desire to see that whatsoever.
Yeah, I was interested to see it only because it looked like it could have been kind of a funny little quirky romance that with a lot of Gondryisms, as I would call it, which I guess you could be identified as. Like I said, they're not visual effects, though some of them could be. But they play as effects. Like, have you ever seen the Knives Out video that he did for Radiohead? A lot of like dream sequence-y kind of large heads and big.
That one Foo Fighters video.
He did that one
too,
Everlong for Foo Fighters. He's got a collection of his videos out there, and a good number of them kind of fit this rule that we're talking about. And the thing I had with Science Asleep is that it really did some of that, but it just sort of felt like it was just him doing that because he kind of wanted to do it, and it didn't.
Right.
The story just wasn't there, so it was kind of unfortunate. But maybe him and Kaufman will team up and do some other nifty thing again. Though I guess
Kaufman is directing his own now.
Oh, he's
It's actually I think it might be in the can. It's supposedly coming out later this year. But there's a new article column in the LA Times that's been going for the last year that is about screenwriting, and it's every I don't know what day it is, Thursday or something like that. And the first column this guy did was basically this masturbatory piece about Charlie Kaufman, and about how this person who's writing the column must have been a screenwriter at some point, because he basically said that Charlie Kaufman was the greatest person to ever walk the earth, and that now
ever since he was writing episodes at Get a Life or whatever.
Don't even get me started on that. That's fantastic. The fact that Charlie Kaufman was now getting a chance to put his own
vision,
his own brilliance, it not only was it on paper, but now he gets to take it off the paper and put it exactly how
we'll
he wants.
We'll see. I mean, well,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll see. Because what happened? What was so good about the other movies that he did with a few of the other movies he did with other people?
Well, like the stuff he did with Jones.
Spike Jones. Yeah, the stuff was fantastic because Spike Jones and to a certain extent Michel Gondry, those more dreamlike, are extremely, extremely visually oriented. Well, like head and shoulders above any other sort of music video directors in terms of what they see on screen.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's maybe a couple other people you could throw in there. Yeah, Chris Cunningham.
I don't think he's ever.
He hasn't done very much. He was going to do a Neuromancer movie, I was totally looking forward to. But
his Aphex Twin videos are just the most horrifying, creepy things ever. The first film that Gondry and Kaufman did together was a straight to video thing called Human Nature. Did you ever see that?
It wasn't straight to video.
It was.
I saw it at the theater.
How long was it out there? Like
I don't
days?
Know. But I that's was
you
that,
saw
back
it.
When
you
I was
saw
going,
it the second day before they.
Yeah, this was back when I was living down in. Down in SoCal, and so I guess I had access to theaters that would play, but it was like at a mall theater.
I think it might have played at the Minor up here for like a weekend or something.
Human Nature. No, I remember that.
I watched that when it came on video, and I was thoroughly disappointed by it. I think it was mostly the direction. I thought there were actually some pretty funny parts of dialogue and so forth, and there were some interesting scenes. I thought there was one scene when what's that guy's name? Ian Reese Davies, or was it Reese Ifans? That's the guy's name. Yeah. And he was. he'd finally become civilized, and they were sitting in a restaurant, and he said something about Tim Robbins said, "Well, what do you say to this waitress?" And he's like, "I will have the something something," and then he's like, "Thank you," and then he got up and started humping her immediately.
Yeah, exactly.
There were certain funny parts like that in it, but for the most part, I thought this was Charlie Kaufman trying to prove that he can take this most far out thing in his mind and make a movie out of it. And then they put a music director.
Yeah.
Music video director on it. But I think that over on the whole, the Spike Jones stuff works better with Kaufman's stuff. The LA Times piece about this thing was talking about how this new movie was something that is going to completely and utterly blow your mind, and that it's...
Well, we'll see. I've always tried to stay low-key about my descriptions for my own stuff, and even for other people's stuff to a large extent. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Or whatever. Versus, cut out all the adjectives. The first thing you do when you describe things. First of all, anyone that's making a movie, 9 times out of 10, they're not a genius. Yeah. I mean, maybe Shane Carruth can be a genius, the guy that did Primer, because he was like a mathematician, then he composed the music and he shot the movie. I mean, he did everything for that movie and had.
He
to
must
have
been a genius because I still don't understand.
Yeah, and there's like message boards that continue to go on. So okay, Shane Carruth, he's a genius. in some cases, Michel Gondry with some of his music video ideas are kind of genius because they really would require heavy level geometric thinking in order to put those together.
I get what you're saying because basically, I mean, anyone who's making a film, it's not because they're better than other people. It's because they talk to the right people and they schmooze their way into the
position. And they might have good, clever ideas, but it's more just a notion of, no, it's a movie. I mean, you know, it's like keep this stuff all relative in terms of the way you assess it compared to everything else in the world. You know, there's your real life where you have real relationships with real people and things like that, and then there's movies, and movies are a source of entertainment, and they can teach you something about this or that on some level, but in the end, they are all a form of propaganda because they are all pitching some kind of message with some kind of way. Like we said before, even an apolitical statement is a political statement. So when you start giving too much praise, when the praise is too high, and it's a bit of a circle jerk, and you got to just kind of step away from it and be like, no, they're just making movies and having fun with it, you know? Then it doesn't all become so critical and so crazy.
There's definitely levels, though, of, you know, I mean, there are even guys like Akiva Goldsman or someone like that, who is really a hack by any sort of artist sense, but who, someone like that, and then in terms of any sort of director.
He's just a jobber, you know?
Yeah, exactly, but even someone like that or... some sort of horrible film director like McGee or something like that, who really just kind of just makes schlock. That sort of person is still, you can say, is technically better than someone who's making B movies that are straight to whatever.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, that there's the technical side, but I mean, that kind of goes without saying. But in my opinion, like if that's their job, they should be able to do it.
But not even the technical style because for instance, you mentioned. This is really, really goes around in a circle here, but you mentioned Mako earlier.
Yeah.
And I remember that. You remember the bad guy from Mortal Kombat? Awful 1999 Dolph Lundgren movie called Bridge of Dragons.
Okay.
And it has this guy in it. Anyway, this movie is every single... It's like they had a monkey sit down in front of a computer that had... an action movie, like he pushed action movie button, and if he randomly pushes
all
buttons,
the cuts were proper to an action movie.
Something? But it had every sort of cliche you can have and something like that. It was really, you know, it's rated R for some reason. There was no foul language. There was every time they shoot someone, there's no, you know, explosion of blood. The person just goes
probably just a case of it being over. Rated R because no one just gave it a second thought. Yeah. You know,
and the idea that something like this was made by people who were actually trying to make something. How many people who were making this film thought, this is good, man?
Mm,
yeah, and I guarantee you, a lot of them did. And that's what I think separates, is that everyone who's making something's got to think this is good. That's not always true, because you hear in interviews by John Landis and Coppola and stuff like that, like they'll tell you some of their movies, they're like, you know, when this movie was done, I thought, this is garbage. No one's going to like this.
That's when it's done, you know.
Well, even while they're shooting, they'll think that, you know, I don't know how this is going to turn out. This is going to be
crap. And you never do. And I think that's the scary part. Yeah. It's sort of as a crapshoot. I mean, I think when you think about all the pieces being put together properly, it can break down at any one of those stages.
But when it comes down to it, and say Scorsese has a film like The Departed come out, every movie Scorsese comes out with, he's got to think when it's done. Even if he's had doubts and fears up to certain points, he's got to think, you know, I just made a good movie. At the same time, that is the thing that makes these guys similar to a B-movie director is, after this B-movie director has just made this movie full of just female anatomy and people getting their heads cut off, and, you know...
Which could also be female anatomy, right, from a technical standpoint.
And they come out with this thing, and then after it's done, and they've seen a final cut of it, they're like, I am the greatest director who has ever lived. This thing is going to...
Wow.
I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to get a good directing gig out of this. I'm going to be able to finally direct my...
is efficient to get me to
piece
do my
about
Magnus
Revolutionary
Opus.
War. Yeah. How come there aren't enough... there aren't more Revolutionary War films?
I don't know. I mean, there's a decent number of books about it, but I think there's a lot to do with just the locations. Right. I mean, really, if you think about it, it's just a lot of guys fighting with sticks in the woods.
That's cool.
I mean, that is cool.
You know what's interesting is that...
tri-corner hats and stuff, yeah.
Without having, you know, without seeing pictures and stuff, of course, because, you know, there weren't really pictures of it, but if you, growing up and doing, you know, school stuff, you learn about the different wars, and I have certain images of things in my mind, and for some reason, in my mind, the Revolutionary War was all fought at night.
Oh,
it was all fought at night. Because all the stories you hear are about a certain guy getting on his horse and running from one town to another in the middle of the night.
Paul Revere.
And, exactly. And guys popping up out of the woods in the middle of the night. And people throwing tea in the ocean in the middle of the night. And all the big stories have to do with the fact that it's dark when they're doing this stuff. So every time I see Revolutionary War stuff, you know, the Washington crossing whatever river.
Potomac. Yeah.
With his dudes in his
maybe
boat.
It was
in
the Delaware.
Maybe that thing was the Delaware, yeah. In the middle of the night. And so the idea that these guys fought at all during the day is just, like, blasphemous to me.
You had real problems with the Patriot, right?
I did, actually. Not only the fact that Mel Gibson thought highly of himself enough to free his slaves.
Oh, great,
you know, 100 years before that was actually going to even. Do you remember that part?
No, I didn't even see the whole movie. I guess I just didn't care.
He has
about it.
Basically, some British guys come up to him and mention his slaves working all around him. He's like, "These aren't my slaves. I set them free. They choose to still work for me," or something like that.
That's,
you know,
fantastic. Yeah,
yeah.
Just what is it? That was like the last, like the thralls of the Roland Emmerich, Dean Devlin. Like, let's try and make an epic.
Exactly.
It's just a piece of crap.
Yeah.
Like, why are people still giving them money?
Are they? What have they done since the Day After Tomorrow?
Even both of them doing
that?
Day
was
after
one
tomorrow?
Of them. It was Emmerich.
Emmerich, yeah.
And then didn't he also, one of them had something to do with Alien, not director, but Alien versus Predator. One of them was like a producer on it or
maybe,
something.
Maybe,
like
the other one probably was.
Was it Paul Anderson?
Paul W.S. Anderson,
yeah. Got to make sure you differentiate between P.T. and
P.W.S. Yeah, don't
want to
get P.T. and P.W.S. confused.
There's too many Paul Andersons out there.
P.T.'s been just sort of hanging around Alton until he died, but now he's going to get back into it, so we'll see.
Yeah, what kind of junk is he going to come out with? Speaking of him, I liked Punch Drunk Love, and it was a little too strange to be really considered something you'd think that was a great film or anything. But,
yeah,
I think Boogie Nights is one of the best movies that has come out in the last like 25 years. I think it really had that much in terms of comedy, drama, character depth. He's a really great dialogue writer.
Anderson?
Really great dialogue writer, and then Magnolia, someone must have told him, "You're a really great dialogue writer," because Magnolia was full of the most just garbage. I read the script for Magnolia before I watched the movie, and the script is like, he writes like Woody Allen does, which is he puts in uhs and ums. There's ellipses everywhere. He writes it exactly how he thinks that these people are going to talk in real life. And if they're ever filming and you hear someone, in some movies you'll hear someone make a mistake and say, Woody Allen will allow people to, he keeps in when people stumble over words because it makes it sound more realistic, even though the rest of his dialogue doesn't sound realistic. P.T. Anderson writes it so that every time you hear something like that, he planned it. He plans people to stumble over words. It's just, I mean,
it can be a little self-indulgent.
Yeah, totally,
yeah,
totally.
I mean,
what do you think of him?
I'm kind of the same opinion of you. I don't think I have such a high praise for Boogie Nights. I mean, I thought it was a good movie, but I just was like, okay. I think I guess I'm kind of turned off by Mark Wahlberg just all the time. I mean, it's one of those cases where it's not fair to judge a movie based on who's like the star, and I know that. But
it's got a great supporting cast.
It does. Yeah. You know, John C. Reilly's good.
Yeah.
Burt Reynolds is pretty. Burt Reynolds, I don't know. I always think of Smokey
Philip Seymour Hoffman was good in it.
Yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman's always pretty good too.
Don Cheadle. That was the beginning of Don Cheadle's up and coming
rise.
Yeah,
yes.
Meteoric rise to mediocrity.
Yeah,
I don't think he's really ever risen above. He's not like the type of guy that you're going to base a movie that's not about Rwandans.
Well, I don't know. He's doing that drama with Adam Sandler that's coming out.
Right,
that's
true.
Me.
I think
so
that's
we'll
mostly
see,
an Adam Sandler vehicle, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
see.
He may be the main protagonist in that other guy's, but I think it's really still something that if Sandler wasn't in that, it probably wouldn't be.
Oh, I'm pretty sure.
They're like, you know, listen, we want Pauly Shore to play this guy. Cheadle's the other guy. They're like, we're going to pass.
Yeah, we're going to pass. Not going to happen.
Pauly Shore.
No, so I mean, I don't know. Anderson, I think I like his style on some level, but it does kind of play like, I don't know, sort of like a bunch of like diatribe on middle class culture or something.
I could be wrong here, but isn't his next thing called There Will Be Blood or something like that?
Maybe.
I think that's his next thing.
I've seen interviews with him, and he seems like the kind of guy that's got a sense of humor and in terms of like his approach to stuff. But he does seem like maybe he's a bit cocky and things like that.
Right.
So it's kind of like, okay, dude, you know, show me what you got. And, you know, okay, that's okay. That's good or that's not. You know,
Have you seen Heart 8?
Yeah, Heart 8.
Yeah, I didn't think that was that great. It had some decent, you know, aspects to it. But for the most part, I think that was just basically something to prove that he could make a movie that had, you know, that was smart enough to involve big actors so that he could get something made before he went to Boogie Nights, which was something that he really had to, I think, push on.
On getting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know. Just the amount of content that he's put out there, it's kind of like, well, we'll see. We'll see where he goes.
He doesn't have a prodigious amount of stuff.
Well, I think that's because he was, like, he was being, like, the stand-in for Altman for a couple of his last pictures. So maybe he was studying while he was working. Maybe he was literally on set with Altman every day because Altman was, you know, about ready to kick the bucket, you know?
You think he held his genitals while he was urinating and stuff. He helped him along every part of his life. He put the death shroud over Altman after he passed away.
I have no idea. I just think that it's possible.
He fed him in the morning.
It's possible that he might have just been like the assistant to as a director or something. I really don't know what the term would have been. It sounded like maybe he was just the guy that was signed on for insurance purposes if Altman kicked the bucket in the middle of filming. But
that's pretty sad.
Well, but, I mean, if he was old enough, then, you know.
I wonder if they told Altman that during the, you know, Altman, we plan
on. He did know about that.
We plan on you dying soon.
I remember seeing an interview with Altman probably about 10 years ago where he was talking about issues with making movies, and he brought that up. He made a point of, the fact that, insurance becomes an issue as you get older.
Well, what do you think about Mel Gibson as a director?
Let's see. Okay. I'll admit this right now. I've seen Braveheart maybe once. It was super popular with, like, my peer group when it was coming up, you know, because it was, like, a big bloody sword fight movie.
Yeah.
I just didn't latch onto it like so many people did as, like, this quintessential, like, and I like the whole individual against the crappy society theme, but for some reason that one just didn't do it for me. And, you know, I was kind of almost, like, laughing a little bit at the end when he's getting his guts ripped out because it was just so melodramatic and I'm like, wait, first of all, I don't think he'd be able to like save freedom if he didn't have any guts anymore, you know?
Maybe he still had them, they were attached, they were just strung
but he wouldn't get the reverb in his body, his diaphragm wouldn't work as well.
They were very carefully pulling his intestines out.
Exactly. So I guess I have to give Braveheart I haven't seen it in a while. Maybe I'm more mature now, so I can judge those things a little better. And then, let's see, he did Man Without a Face before that.
Right.
And that just, I don't know, that was just a story. But
let's just focus on his three super preachy melodramatic.
Okay, so
Passion of the Christ, Braveheart, and then Apocalypto. So what do you think of
those? Haven't seen Apocalypto now yet.
It's definitely worth seeing.
And it looks like it's got some interesting visuals, but I'm always really hesitant about movies about New World peoples, you know, quote, big quotes there. Because a lot of times it all kind of just, it's so informed by, you know, the conquistadors and you know, the cowboys and everybody else that just essentially massacred them. So it's like, I don't know how to think about their cultures without thinking about that aspect of, like, the inevitability of it. So I guess they all kind of feel like they all are going to have tragic endings no matter what. And so it's hard to even, like, immediately, like, try to care about those characters.
But the interesting thing about Apocalypto is that it is, there's almost nothing about the culture. There's one scene when they go to a big city, and that's the scene where they're sacrificing people and cutting their heads off and rolling them down the stairs. And you see they walk through the one thing Mel Gibson's been doing. A lot of points, it was the same thing as Passion of the Christ, which is it's interesting that no screenwriting class will ever teach one of his movies as a good way to do something, because Passion of the Christ was structured so that basically it was almost like there weren't acts. It was like he walks through the city for a long time, and for 15 minutes we follow as people mock him and throw things at him and spit on him.
It's sort of a form of like exposition on the character.
Right, but it's constant, repetitive, and it's something that is really, it's you're tense the whole time, and you're thinking, why are they doing this to him? I don't know what's going on.
Well, you kind of are, and you are, but a story like that, I mean, I haven't seen that movie either. I'll admit, I'm bad. I should watch more of these movies.
Well, here's the thing with those two: is that so much of the film is there's almost no plot. It's just like
an event.
Yeah, Apocalypto is at its essence a chase movie. Mm-hmm. It's a chase movie. It's an action film. This guy, something happens, he runs away. Everyone's chasing him. And then there's constant ramping up of tension. There's constant stakes being raised. His family's trapped in a cave. The water level's rising. On top of that, his wife is about to give birth.
In an elevator with the guy that, you know,
it's constantly ramped up like that. And the Passion of the Christ is its own form of movie, definitely. It's its own genre, really. It's got, ever since the conflict is locked, which is, oh, you know, here come the guys to come and take Jesus away and kill him.
Yeah.
you know what's going to happen, and it's I know it's a, it's the old passion play thing, but it's I can't ever watch the movie again because it was too not hard to watch, but it took so much out of me. Just even if I wasn't,
it was just kind of emotionally draining.
Yeah, even if, I wasn't a Christian, this was just like, let's watch a movie about a guy being tortured before they kill him. Exactly. It's so emotionally draining. You're sitting here tense the whole time as you watch. There's this one scene in Passion where they're scourging his back,
yeah.
and he like puts it in slow mo and has a scene of a shot of the whip sticking in his back, and then he pulls away in slow motion, like, you know, blood spraying out and like chunks of skin are flying out along with the thing, and he's like,
it's very very vitriolic.
This guy is really. I don't know what's wrong with him. There's something wrong with Mel Gibson. This is beyond the thing that, you know, behind his drunkenness and the whole, you know, the Jews are behind all the world's
the anti-Semitism.
Drunk. Yeah, but behind that whole thing, there is something like in his the way the mechanisms of his mind work is like the reason why he's been able to make these movies is because of his name alone. And they're very well shot, and I think for the most part he's a decent director. But the fact that he focuses on
violence,
on not just the violence, but the whole visceral part of it, and how it's almost too much. And Apocalypto has a lot of stuff like that in it. You know something is coming, and he knows you know something is coming. Like someone's about to get their throat slit, and he plays it out. Talk to the guy first. I'm about to slit this guy's throat. What do you think about that? Push him around, hold the knife to him, take it off. Finally do it.
Finally
and then
do
focus
it.
On the blood pouring down the guy for 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's,
you know?
So it's pretty much plays a little gratuitous in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, it's hard to say. It's really interesting. It's almost like Russ Meyer or something like that. It's like watching one of those old movies where you know something is coming, and he knows you know it's coming, and he plays it up so much, and that's the whole point. You watch it. You watch his next one because you know what's going to happen, and part of you wants to see, in Russ Meyer's case, a woman with double E cup size running around, bouncing everywhere, and then killing guys. And then in Mel Gibson's case, the American way, you know, we want to see brutal graphic violence.
Yeah.
I do.
I guess. But then you talk about how you don't want to see it again after that.
Well, just the passion. I could see Apocalypto again. The passion was just...
The kind of violence.
It was focusing on one thing. And it probably has something to do with my religion and faith, too.
You're not
going
to be able to separate that.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
Even though it's his Catholic take on it. The Catholic anti-Semitic take
indeed,
on it.
Indeed, yeah.
You know.
Okay, so we're talking about different directors and their styles, and so I guess, yeah, for me, I don't know. I think Mel Gibson falls in the category hasn't done very much yet. I mean, not hasn't done very much. I mean, he's done big things with these
when
movies.
He does sci-fi, you'll respect him, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. Or just when he's done more movies. I mean, Altman never did sci-fi. Or did he? Maybe he did. I think he did. He did a weird one with Paul Newman. It's sort of one of those, like, it's kind of falls in the whole... category of those ones done in the 70s are almost future dystopias, you know, kind of like Soylent Green and stuff.
He did one of those?
He did one of those where it's like the world is like after, and it's like post-nuclear winter, and it's all...
Wow.
Yeah, I remember a blog I go to.
Post-nuclear winter. And the protagonist has to travel across Rhode Island to a Twinkie factory?
Something similar to that, yes. No, I mean, it's cold, though. Like it's literally like a winter. I think that was a big part of it. Maybe ice is even in the title. I don't know. You could IMDb Robert Altman and cross-reference it with Paul Newman.
For some reason, that doesn't sound like something I'd want to see. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't think I really wanted to see it either. I haven't seen it. But
So would you take a mediocre director in the pantheon of things who has done one of every genre, who's done a successful comedy, a successful sci-fi?
Oh, you mean if they've all been considered successful?
Well, not just successful, but things that were – maybe they weren't considered – the best movie ever made in their genre, each one. So not like a Kubrick type thing, but like, or you know, even someone who could be considered like that, but someone who made successful, good movies in each genre. Would you take a director like that over someone who focused on a certain type of thing, but made them as best he possibly could, you know?
Okay, so like, you're talking about Scorsese, who by and large has done crime pictures.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's just accept that. Casino,
sure.
Goodfellas,
and even his non-crime pictures have.
I mean, I didn't see Kundun or Age of Innocence,
Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore,
or Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. But look, they're basically about New York crime, or in the case of The Departed, they're Boston, so it's a different ethnic group, but whatever. It's kind of all the same story. So I can appreciate those and stuff. But
and
I,
he does them, and he does them better than anyone else.
Yeah,
we can,
he does.
We can say
and,
that,
and,
right?
And so like I can say, like, oh, if Scorsese's doing another crime picture, that's great. I mean, my brother really likes Goodfellas. It's like his favorite movie.
Right,
when I was telling him about The Departed, and, you know, he's a little, you know, he's having fun with his friends, and I'm telling them about how he just was watching it and how I thought it was pretty good. And the other guy's kind of like, well, what, you know, and, like, you know, my description is, you know, too involved, and my brother's just like, I saw a commercial for it, and it looks like a straight-up Martin Scorsese movie.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, it is. Yeah, you guys are going to like it. Though I did have problems with it, but, you know.
We'll talk about that.
We can talk about that later. So I would be interested if I heard all of a sudden that Martin Scorsese was going to do, like, an Arthur C. Clarke novel. You know, partly because it's all about sort of the pieces for me.
Right. And so who has mastered a wide variety of genres? Not mastered, but is good at them.
Who's covering multiple levels of genre. Let's think. In a weird way, Kubrick did it.
Kubrick did
a great. I mean, 2001 was a good science fiction movie.
Very good.
Barry Lyndon was a good period piece. I mean, it was kind of a boring story, but if you look at it from a visual standpoint, Kubrick's meticulousness just plays.
He put his own thing on the war film.
These huge lenses.
Yeah.
So that they could actually shoot and expose the film with candlelight in a couple scenes of Barry Lyndon. And in that plays, like, it looks like a painting. Or something. And then, you know, he did Full Metal Jacket. All of his stories are always based on some kind of a novel or a book. So it's never like Kubrick sat down and wrote a Kubrick movie. He even, if you go back to the oldest Kubrick stuff, like his short, Killer's Kiss, I think was maybe what it was called. Because they all had Kiss or Killer in them. Which they were a lot of film noirs that had really awful titles. It's too bad. But the title never represent the movie. But that was a cool short about a boxer, and it was in it was a good noir. And even The Killing, which is why I probably would get it confused, which is a full-length feature about, like, a noir that he did, was cool, too. So, I mean, Kubrick, I think, has kind of done a lot of different genres and done them all. They're almost all pretty decent.
He even
movies.
Did comedy. He did Dr. Strangelove, which is really satire. You can't really say it's a straight up comedy, but it's good. But it's before
we were inundated with Colbert and Stewart, and just like the point where they don't even have a sense of humor about it anymore. It's like you can feel the bitterness in them, and it's like. Or just the general, like, belief.
The reason why...
In the catastrophism of it all, the world really is going to end, and I'm just going to, you know, pretend it's funny.
The thing that I have a problem with you mentioning Kubrick is I think that he's really mastered. I think that he's at the same level in any of those genres as Scorsese is as a crime director. I'm talking about someone below Kubrick's level.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of examples we can come up with here because I'd have to just think about it off the top of my head.
We could do...
I almost want to say Spielberg.
I was just thinking that.
Because Spielberg is not, I mean, he's a fantastic commercial director. But besides Schindler's List, I don't know if he is a masterful film director. He always falls into, he's got too much sentimental.
Yeah, that's too just much like, sentimentalism. I want, in the end, I want everyone to kind of like me.
Exactly.
That's partially John Williams' fault.
He's done sci-fi in a couple of cases, and both of those were almost family-ish. Close Encounters wasn't really family, but
no. And Close Encounters is a sci-fi is really loose sci-fi.
It's mostly
like a character study.
It is, but I mean, in the overall, you know, scheme
E.T.
of thing,
I guess is another sci-fi.
Exactly, and that's the one that's
study.
More family thing. But you know, AI. Everything else is like action adventure type stuff. The Jurassic Park and so forth. It's hard to say that, you know, I don't think Spielberg could just do a comedy. 1941 is a good example of that.
Yeah.
He can't do
comedy. I've seen bits of that, and I remember liking that when I was a really little kid. But then again, one thing I also always fall for is I love the ensemble, like, A, B, C, D story movies where it's like a lot is going on. And eventually, it's best if it all ties together, and naturally you do care about a good number of the characters. And I feel like 1941 had that. It had, like, there was multiple storylines with different kind of crazy antics going on.
Right.
And it did have a cool look to it. You know, it had, like, the zoot suits in the 40s stuff. So there was parts of it that but like I said, I haven't seen it all in years. Like, Johnny Carson was what we watched after that. To put context to it, we watched that on New Year's Eve when I was a little kid. It was the first year I was ever, like, stayed up till midnight. And then we watched Johnny Carson, and that was like, this is so strange.
It's hard to say. I think when it comes down to it for me, I'd rather see the same sort of thing by the masterful director, because you know you're going to have something to talk about afterwards.
That's true.
And if you're going with a standard genre film and any other type by some guy who's just trying new things, it's going to be different. You know, actually, one person who's kind of done that so far is Darren Aronofsky, which is...
Well, he's only done three.
I know, and the three that he's done are very different in...
Really?
I don't really want to say genre. The tone is very similar. Okay. The tone is very similar in all of them. He has a certain thing going with all of them. But he's picked different... you know, Requiem for a Dream was way outside the context of... Or way outside where you'd think that he would go next after, if you just watched Pi and you say, I wonder what this guy did next, if you didn't know. And then after Requiem for a Dream, you think maybe he was going to start doing stark, startling dramas.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the guy who did Babel, Inarritu, or whatever his name is,
mm-hmm.
All his movies leading up to that are it's the same film. This guy's Amores Perros and 21 Grams.
Yeah.
These are all the same film. It's different people's stories all intertwining in some sad, depressing way.
Yeah, just some kind of... It's just bummer movies.
Exactly.
They can be highbrow because they're bummer movies.
That's the same sort of thing. This guy has made the same movie over and over. I don't really want to say that Scorsese's made the same movie over and over, but it's like the same sort of genre. Like, you know,
back to the Oscars, they had little people doing...
Babel was another one that was best picture nominated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They had little people doing sound bites whenever someone would get announced that they won an award. You know, it'd be like, you know, when some actress won, they'd say some lame thing that they'd probably just said to them on the red carpet.
Yeah.
And then, like, Martin Scorsese, he says, when he just won for The Departed, that The Departed is the first movie he's ever made with a plot. And my brother and I just start cracking up. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, I guess, kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, but in the same way, you get that whole, like, the resolution with which character were you supposed to care about.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's all murky in all of those Scorsese pictures.
I don't know,
because they're usually kind
of
prime
people. I think
people.
If you point at any of his... The certain ones kind of just flowed by what would happen at regular events. Casino, I think Goodfellas did the same thing. You know who's actually done some different stuff? Bryan Singer.
That's fair. The Usual Suspects, Pupil, two X-Men movies, and Superman.
Yeah, he's falling into the thing of doing the same genre now.
And he's talking about how that's what he always wanted to do.
Yeah, but he started out as he did. I mean, his first huge thing was this crime drama, which is a really well-made crime drama.
Neo-noir,
And then. App Pupil is just strange in terms of what genre do I put it in. It's almost like a horror film. It's not, but
call that a suspense movie.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, I like a director who just makes interesting choices.
Yeah.
If you hear the premise of something and it sounds like, wow, and the same director is doing that every time, I think that's a good sign, because this guy is taking on...
Yeah, it's the. I think you're
Fincher,
right.
For instance, no matter what he makes, I'll end up watching it because, to this point, he could make something about some guy just drinking milk for 2 hours, and I would be able to live off the fact that everything else he's done to this point has been like, you know, I'm gonna take this thing and I'm gonna have a really distinct visual look.
Yeah, that's true. Fincher's
the game I thought was like a weak premise for a movie. And then I watched it, and his visual style makes the thing really creepy.
I know, like,
really
I got
creepy.
That on DVD just because it's worth watching.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
It's so sleek. And, I mean, everything I've seen by him is does kind of fit that. And I think you're right, that whole idea of a director, he's taking on – what's the premise of what he's taking on now? And, like, you were talking about this, I haven't seen any of the movies that the guy did, Babel did, but you just essentially described them.
Yeah,
sounds like
it's the same thing.
It's the same premise every time.
21 Grams was the best out of the three, I think. His first one, Amores Perros, was very interesting at the time. And they were also all written by the same guy, which apparently they've divorced now. This guy is not going to write for him any longer because this director basically says that this writer is he wants more credit than he deserves. They've been arguing over the age-old thing. Who is the auteur?
Yeah,
who is it? Is it the writer or the director?
Yeah, either one of them is wrong. How about that?
Yeah, in this case, the media is really making it to seem out. The media, like, everyone cares. But the critic...
Like
critic
cares,
They're making it out that the writer in this case is the bad guy.
Okay.
That this guy is like, I did this and this and this, and he's really making...
Well, that's the way it always goes. The writer always gets the short end of the stick
comes
to a movie. I remember the whole... anecdote about Frank Capra winning an Oscar and thanking all kinds of people, and then the next day at his office, his writer sent him a full ream of a script. You know, like it was like set up like a script filled with empty pages and a little note that said, "Here, go make another Oscar-winning picture with this." So the writer does get the short end
of
the stick, but in the end, it's kind of like completely out of the writer's hand once it goes into
production. And it always comes back to something. You know, which people will argue with until, you know, the day the earth ends.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is how much the fact that a movie is a visual medium and that you're seeing something that is, it's basically one person's vision, even if there's a source material that is completely an original script by a writer, the director is taking this.
Yeah.
And he's making it his own, however way he wants to. So you can always argue that way. The auteur theory is kind of correct because the director is making this his own, especially if they have a very distinct visual style.
I think the auteur theory...
Hitchcock, obvious. Plays, very obvious.
Yeah, plays best, and you find this happening. I think in most cases where people can best apply the auteur theory, you're looking at a collective of people that have worked together among a number of movies.
Yeah.
So you're looking at literally like the same guys writing the scripts for this director.
Got the same cinematographer.
And the same cinematographer, and probably the same editor. And even in some cases, like if you look at the Spielberg stuff, it's like
the same
John Williams doing the music
always,
again.
And the same producers. He's got the same producers on half his films.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you end up seeing coming to this like, okay, yeah, that's it. That's it. You put him in front, the director, because he's like the general in the army,
right?
And he's leading.
But it's
the force,
really a collective.
But it's really that collective. And so understanding that it's that collective is the difference.
And then the opposite end of that is the idea that I mean, with Charlie Kaufman's things, that's very obvious that I mean, you can put any director really in front of a Charlie Kaufman thing, and people are going to see it because of Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah, that's the whole star system coming into play.
It is, like, absolutely.
And that usually does happen with directors.
Yeah.
Or
and it doesn't
actors.
Happen so often with writers. And that's
no, it doesn't.
Thing,
and, so. I mean, I think the Kaufman thing even is somewhat esoteric still. You're not going to get a mass audience knowing who Charlie
Kaufman
is. You're
going to get guys who wear Rivers Cuomo glasses and wear sweaters. And,
yeah, there's a degree of the emo hipster crowd is going to be into it.
So, you know, this kind of makes me think again of the Oscar thing. So there was Babel. I think, was Last King of Scotland actually nominated for Best Picture, or
I
was
don't
it just
believe
Best
so.
Actor?
I'm not sure. I know it was Best Actor because Forest Whitaker won.
And, you know, we started this by talking about the Oscars, and when it comes down to it, I think that no longer is it viable as any sort of benchmark of what's good. Because
it's not a barometer.
It's not, because there are so many things that come out.
I think that's just the fact that there's more stuff being made now. And so the Oscars has maybe stayed the same rather than changed, and so it's appealing to the same
the
crowd.
The Oscars have definitely stayed the same, but it's kind of hard for me to say because I've definitely seen more newer movies than older ones. But the older movies that I've seen that won Best Picture, and I've seen other movies that were nominated in the same years back in the 60s and 50s and so forth, they were fantastic films.
Yeah.
And films that I've seen in the 90s that won Best Picture, because that's really when I watched the Oscars the most was in the 90s. Were not always what I considered even to be a good movie.
Best Picture?
It was nominated. It didn't
and
win.
It's like a little kid movie about a talking pig, which I always thought was kind of cute.
It was a good movie. I liked it.
At the same time, I'm like, that's for Best Picture.
You know who directed the sequel? George Miller.
No, George Miller did the first one, too. George Miller, the doctor, who was an Australian physician who started off doing the Mad Max movies.
Right. He didn't direct the first one.
Maybe he didn't direct it, but he was involved in it.
He was involved with it. Yeah, he directed the second one. If you watch the second one.
I've heard there's really weird shit going on in the second one.
It is dark, man.